Hello again, I'm Armin Alney. Democrat Barack Obama is now officially a lame duck president, with the Senate controlled by Republicans and the House with the biggest GOP majority since 1928, the days of Calvin Coolidge. How did they do it? And what's next in the halls of Congress and in the White House? That's later on To the Point. First, this story. As predicted, the turnout for yesterday's state and local elections was dismal. Statewide, it was 30%. In Los Angeles County, just 25% of those eligible bothered to vote, less than half what it was 4 years ago. We'll hear about local results, but first let's go statewide. Once again, the Republicans failed to win a single state office. Is the party over? Alan Hoffenblum is a former Republican official, now co-editor of the California Target Book, considered by both parties to be the last word on legislative and congressional districts. Hi, Alan. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Warren.
This was such a Republican year, and yet it didn't happen in California. Is there anything left of the party?
Oh, yes. First of all, their main goal was to try to break the supermajority in both the state Senate and the Assembly, and that they were successful to do. It shows you the point of the Republican Party, where their main goal is no longer have less than one-third of the elected office holders in the state legislature. But they were able to do that. They defeated three Democratic incumbents. Those are the first Democratic incumbents to be defeated since 1994. And then they had two very heated races for the state Senate, one in the Central Valley, Andy Vidick, and one that open seat down in Central Orange County, won by Janet Wynn, the first Vietnamese American woman ever elected to the state legislature and an Orange County supervisor. So were they, their objective on the legislative level, they were very, very successful. And they could even take back two of the congressional seats they lost 2 years ago, both in Sacramento and in San Diego. So on that level, they achieved their goal. As far as the statewide, I'm going to say I'm disappointed. I had wished the state party could have used some resources to get Pete Peterson particularly a little bit more support, because I think he came very, very close.
He's the Republican that ran for Secretary of State
and endorsed practically by every newspaper in the state. And maybe Ashley Swearengen, too.
She's the mayor of Fresno that ran for state controller.
State controller. But when you consider that we're only 28% Republican registration, many of us think it's all but impossible until we turn the registration around to win the statewide. But they were very successful in what they wanted to do here on the state level.
Well, very successful in the sense that they prevented the supermajority from continuing. But did the Democrats ever do anything with the supermajority?
No, but it was psychological. And also, something else happened yesterday. Two of the Republicans who got elected were elected what would be called purple or real competitive seats. David Hadley defeated the incumbent, Al Murasuchi, a Japanese-American. He defeated him, an incumbent Democrat, down in the South Bay area, of Torrance, the Beach Cities, and Palos Verdes. And then we had Catherine Baker was able to defeat Kim Sobrante up there in Contra Costa, which is an open seat long held by the Democrats. And these are seats, by the way, are two Republicans that are moderate. They're both pro-choice, and they both favor marriage equality. So what you've been seeing is Republicans in districts that are much more competitive and much more moderate nominating them and getting them elected. The party is still a regional party. It's still weak. But if they haven't been able to at least make some gains in the current environment, then it would have been yesterday's newspaper. But that did not happen.
Alan Hoffenblum, publisher of the California Target Book. Sherry Bebich Jeffy is with us, professor at the Price School of Public Policy at USC, political analyst for KNBC. Always good to have you on our program.
Hi, Warren.
You've spent a lot of time in Sacramento. Do you think that the Republicans can be said to be building at this point?
Well, at least they're not shriveling as much as they were perceived to be shriveling before. The chair of the Republican Party, Jim Brulte, made a strategic decision to concentrate on blocking the Democratic supermajority so that Republicans would be relevant again within the legislative process. And that strategy has worked. Nobody ever expected a Republican on the statewide level to win, but there is a statement to be made, and I think Alan's right. We may be on life support, but nobody's pulled it out from us yet. So I think at least they can try. The reality, however, Warren, is this. Demographics in this state are working very much against the Republican Party. As Alan said, it is still weak. It is still a regional party. The Republican Party has to do with something that it hasn't done yet, which is to attract Latinos, to attract young voters, to attract women. And the good news for them is, if you look at the exit polls on the national level, the Democrats aren't doing that as much anymore. So maybe there's an opening.
Let me introduce Rafe Sonnenschein. He's executive director of the Pat Brown Institute at Cal State LA, another familiar voice on our program. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Warren.
What about the low turnout?
Well, you know, low turnout's driven by the top of the ticket, and there was a zero election campaign for governor. Basically, Governor Brown ran unopposed. I mean, it's a little harsh to say, but I think it's not much different than running unopposed. He hardly campaigned, didn't run any commercials for himself. You had Democrats dominating all the statewide offices, and very few things that were of interest to anybody but, like, the folks on our panel who, you know, would be fascinated by a whole range of races. They really compare that to these Senate races, like in New Hampshire, North Carolina, where people were flooded with information telling them that the entire fate of the Western world depended on their vote. It's probably not too surprising that we didn't turn out very much.
We did have some local campaigns, though, that had a lot of money, that were distributing a lot of literature. One of them was to replace Henry Waxman in the Congress. Rafe Sonnenschein, what happened?
Well, first of all, it was not as competitive as those races in Orange County for Assembly and Senate, which really the two parties were evenly poised. The Democratic candidate, Ted Lieu, was very likely to win that race, and he won by a lot. And the other two really interesting races were between Democrats, which was Marshall Tuck and Tom Torlakson for superintendent of public instruction and Sheila Kuehl against Bobby Shriver. And while those certainly energized Democrats, I really doubt they created the kind of buzz that a blue-red race down to the wire is going to – that's really ultimately the thing that gets people to the polls.
Sherry Babbitt Jeffy, the winner of the supervisorial seat to replace Zev Yaroslavsky, was Sheila Kuehl and not Bobby
Correct.
Shriver. What difference is that going to make, do you think, on the board of supervisors?
Well, you know, the conventional wisdom is, and I agree with the conventional wisdom, that what the election of Sheila Kuehl means is that there will be three pretty strong labor supporters on the board of supervisors. Labor had a victory in the supervisorial race. It supported Sheila. Labor also had a victory on the statewide level with the superintendent of public instruction race. If you would have three labor loyalists, that's going to probably change the direction of policy, change the rhetoric of the debate. It was assumed that had Bobby Shriver won, he would be more of a swing vote, a la Zev Yaroslavsky, who is leaving as the supervisor for the 3rd District. And it wouldn't be quite so much an imprint of the influence of labor on county policy. We'll see, but I have a feeling that it's now 3-2 on the Board of Supervisors if you say it's labor versus business and development. Business and development are 2, and labor are 3 votes.
And the other on the labor coalition would be, if you're correct, Hilda Solis, who is about to take
you're
over
right.
for Gloria Molina, and Mark Ridley Thomas, who wasn't up this year. Rafe Sonnenschein, is it as clear as that? Is Sheila Kuehl somebody who can't run away from her labor support? She got a lot of it.
Well, she got a lot of it, but throughout her career, she hasn't really been identified as strongly with labor as some other Democrats. I think she's friendly to labor. I think the dynamic of being on that board, once they're doing collective bargaining and they're sitting across from the table and they don't want to get labeled as the people who gave away the store, while I think they'd be very sympathetic to labor on issues like minimum wage, where they're not on opposite sides of the table, I'm not sure that they're going to operate as a bloc. Plus, blocs don't really happen on the Board of Supervisors very much. There seem to be a lot of shifting alliances. And who's going to enforce the block anyway if one of those powerful supervisors wants to go their own way?
There are only 5 people, and they are among the most powerful local officials in the United States. I know, Rafe Sonnenschein, that Mark Ridley Thomas has been concerned and somewhat angry at his colleagues, Mike Antonovich and Don Kanabe, because they have joined with Zev Yaroslavsky in taking actions that will sort of tie the hands of the board, even though new members are coming in. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I think it's been a pretty bad idea. I think the supervisors agreed to limit how the supervisors dealt with collective bargaining by requiring a supermajority vote to make certain agreements with the employee unions. So I think it's a really bad idea to tell the voters we're going to have one of the few open elections in the history of the County Board of Supervisors, but we're going to determine what they're able to do when they get in, because after all, they'd be too wild and crazy to make decisions by majority rule. You know, it'll only take three votes to overturn any of those decisions. The board also went ahead and hired a bunch of people for open positions that some people think might not have been the end of the world if those decisions were left to the new board. I really don't think this new board, while it's going to be different from the previous one, is going to, you know, drive the county into the Pacific Ocean necessarily. And I think the voters, you know, basically got to choose who was on the board. And I think that's kind of the way democracy is supposed to work.
Let's go back to the statewide ballot. A lot of the propositions failed, but Proposition 47 did not. Now, this is the state that gave us three strikes and you're out. Proposition 47 goes in exactly the opposite direction, and it passed last night with 58% of the vote. Lenore Anderson is Executive Director of Californians for Safety and Justice. She was one of the authors of Prop 47. Thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon.
Tell us what Prop 47 does and what concerns remain about it.
Well, last night we had a great night. We're very excited about the victory in our campaign. Proposition 47 is a common sense sentencing reform initiative that does two things. The first thing Proposition 47 does is it reclassifies six low-level nonviolent crimes from felony status to misdemeanors. And that will reduce the prison population, and people who will be convicted of these crimes moving forward as misdemeanors will be held accountable in the local criminal justice system instead of in state prisons. The second thing the ballot initiative does is it captures the money that will be saved from reducing prison waste and reducing the use of prison beds for these crimes. It captures that money and it invests it into mental health treatment, drug treatment, victim services, and programs for at-risk youth in public schools. And the idea behind it is to rebalance our, you know, safety and justice priorities in such a way that we can put more investment and time into prevention and stopping the cycle of crime locally and stop wasting so much money on bloated prisons.
There is concern among people who supported the measure that the money you talked about that's supposed to be spent for public schools will go to police officers and security precautions and that sort of thing, rather than things that would be more in line with the language of the other parts of the measure. Are you concerned about that?
Not at all. The measure was written with specificity. So the measure clearly delineates that the money should go to things like truancy, prevention, and support programs for students who may be at risk of either dropping out or being a victim of crime. So the measure is very specific in its attempt to say, look, we know what would help make our community safer. We know that the things that have been underfunded for decades, in large part as a result of a prison building strategy, those are the things that we need to focus on. And a lot of it has to do with helping at-risk youth stay on track and stay out of trouble.
Lenore Anderson again at Californians for Safety and Justice. Let me go back to Alan Hoffenblum, our Republican political consultant, publisher of the California Target Book, longtime student of statewide politics. How is it that California went in a relatively few years from three strikes and you're out to Proposition 47?
Oh, you know, I think a lot of it has to do that there is a consensus out there, you know, that the sentences for drug offenses and such are really too harsh. And, you know, and the voters voted to temper, you know, three strikes and you're out. So I'm not a bit surprised. That's an issue when you're dealing with law and order, even among surveys I've seen with Republicans, is they think the penalty should fit the, you know, the offense. And I think that's why it passed.
Sherry Babbitt Jeffy, you've talked to a lot of legislators, many of whom want to be tough on crime, and also to law enforcement people who opposed this measure, saying that 40,000 prisoners a year aren't going to be prisoners anymore. They're going to be out on the streets. Do you think that a lot of the reason that it passed had to do more with the fact that people found that being tough on crime was expensive?
That's part of it. But the reality of it is there was no opposition campaign. Only the pro side was visible on television. They had enough money, I guess, to buy onto slates. I mean, don't underestimate the power of the media, particularly when the other side of the argument doesn't get its side out. I do think that some of it had to do with the mandate to realign the prison system. I do think some of it had to do with, I don't know if you recall, the young man who had a third strike because he stole a piece of pizza and it was all over the media. Also, our former district attorney, Steve Cooley, gave some visibility to the debate over the three strikes law and whether or not there should be what they call wobblers, misdemeanors, or felonies. So it's not simply because we are suddenly enlightened. It is a confluence, as everything is in politics and in policy decisions. It's a confluence of a whole lot of factors that come together, not the least of which is the ability to get your message out.
Rafe Sonnenschein, are you surprised that the law enforcement people who really want to have the more draconian sentences available to sort of hold over the heads of people to get plea bargains? I forget what percent of all cases are plea bargained. It's like 97%, something like that. And they claim that without those tough sentences to hold over people's heads, they would never get that. Are you surprised they didn't come up with that more money and make more of an effort to defeat this?
Well, you know, a lot of the district attorneys were against this. This was something prosecutors really didn't like, except a couple of prosecutors and an ex-prosecutor or two. But I don't think they saw any value in getting in the way of where the people were heading on this. And this is something where, you know, public opinion is this big giant, and it sort of turns very slowly, but sometimes it really turns. And I think it has turned on these issues. And I think, don't forget, a lot of these prosecutors are elected officials themselves, and I'm not sure there would have been a whole lot of value in them throwing themselves up against the weight of a changed public opinion, which once it changes, by the way, it's kind of hard to get it to go back the other way.
So, Lenore Anderson, back to you. You were one of the authors of Prop 47, 58% of the vote. Did you ever expect to get that much?
I am so delighted that it was a decisive victory. You know, we weren't sure what was going to happen. We were confident that the measure was in strong alignment with general public opinion. We've been aware for years now that the public has had concerns about California's wasted dollars on criminal justice and specifically on prisons. You know, when you talk to most Californians, regardless of political persuasion, by the way, the two biggest problems they've identified for a long time have been, you know, we spend too much money on prisons and we lock up too many people for nonviolent offenses. And so this measure, you know, spoke directly to where we know most Californians' concerns lie on these issues. And we were victorious as a result. So it's a very wonderful outcome.
Worth pointing out that the supporters included Jay-Z and Newt Gingrich, the former Republican Speaker of the House of Representatives. Lenore Anderson, what's next?
We also had support from Rand Paul and the ACLU. I mean, this was a campaign that was really about people of all walks of life coming together, and it's been very exciting to see the diversity of our coalition. What's next? Well, you know, first we want to make sure that Proposition 47 is implemented effectively. We want to make sure that people in the criminal justice system are aware of these changes, both the people who work in the system as well as the people who cycle in and out of it, either as as people who are facing penalties or as crime victims. We did put a lot of money into improving victim services, and we want to make sure that that becomes a reality. So, you know, there's a lot of work to do to make sure that the implementation is solid. But, you know, the other thing that, you know, we are aware of is that this is really the first step. This isn't the end of a campaign. It's the beginning of the kind of changes that need to happen in our state, and that's deep sentencing reform. You know, we went from an era of, you know, building 22 prisons and only one university over a 30-year time period to change that and to put us on a path of smarter investments. We need to go much deeper in thinking through how our penal code should look. We need laws that allow us to focus on stopping the cycle of crime as opposed to one-size-fits-all incarceration approaches. We need our law enforcement dollars focused on serious and violent crime. And we really need to get smart about how we deal with the low levels. And so, Proposition 47 is the first step, and we've got a long way to go, but we're confident that we've shown where Californians are at on these issues, and there'll be increasing cooperation across the political spectrum to get it done.
Lenore Anderson, the Californians for Safety and Justice, one of the authors of Prop 47, 58% of the vote. Rafe Sonnenschein, back to you. Let's go local again and talk more about the race for the Board of Supervisors. Bobby Shriver and Sheila Kuehl looked pretty close down toward the end. I know you moderated a debate between them, so did I. And I think you've written this, that Bobby Shriver might have run for the wrong office.
Well, it's a possibility. I think he got much, much better as a candidate as he went along, but it still was a tougher office as a fit for his personality and his sort of big issue, change-oriented personality, and probably a somewhat better fit for Sheila Kuehl, you know, kind of the argument about being a legislator and all that. I often wondered when I was watching him about him as a member of the House of Representatives, where some of his issues would have really been given a tremendous platform that he could have done. I have to say, though, I thought he finished very strong in this campaign and was a far better candidate at the end than he was at the beginning. I thought it would be a little bit closer at the end, but I think with the turnout profile favoring strong Democratic base voters throughout the whole state, which carried Torlakson and some of the other people to office, I think it was just too much of a mountain for him to climb.
Alan Hoffenblum, quickly, there are some races that have still not been called. Is it possible that California still has the possibility of adding to the Republican majority in the House of Representatives?
Yeah, there's three that are way too close to call. First of all, one of the biggest upsets that it holds is defeating Jim Costa up there in the Central Valley by a candidate who actually spent no money, a man by the name of Johnny DeCero. He has a 736-vote lead over Costa.
Costa's a Democrat.
Over the Democrat, the Republican. I mean, that will be a seat taken away from the Democrats nobody expected. But then the two where over $14 million was spent in each of these races when you add up independent expenditures. Cardamyle has a 752-vote lead over Scott Peters, the incumbent.
And where's that race?
That's down in San Diego. And Julia Brownlee over in Ventura County only has a 530-vote lead over Jeff Rell, a current Republican assemblyman who gave up his seat to run for Congress. So it's still too close to call. Either the Republicans might pick up three seats, or they may not pick up any of those seats. So it's too close to call.
Okay. And in some ways, elections are never over, as we'll find out when we switch to our next program. To the point, I just want to say for those in Santa Monica who may be listening that measure LC is the one that won. There were two measures on the ballot having to do with the Santa Monica Airport. LC stands for local control, and it means that the big money people, the pilots and others who put money into the other measure, measure D, were defeated. I won't go into that in any great length because I don't think a lot of our listeners know about it or are very concerned. But I want to thank all of our guests for being with us. Alan Hoffenblum, again, publisher of the California Target Book, Sherry Bebich Jeffy at USC's Price School of Public Policy and KNBC, Rafe Sonnenschein, executive director of the Pat Brown Institute at Cal State LA, and Lenore Anderson, a director of the Californians for Safety and Justice. Many thanks to you all.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Remember, you can join the conversation on our Which Way LA Facebook page. In a moment, the midterm elections are barely over, but Washington is already focused on 2016. That's on To the Point.